Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
The Crisis Next Door, a weekly report on the biggest conflicts around the world. With host Jason Brooks.
Welcome to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. The Middle East tends to be top of mind when talking about jihadists, with the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda heavily involved in several states. But Africa has been dealing with its own virulent strains of jihadism, and there's little to suggest that the situation is getting better anytime soon, with the Africa Center for Strategic Studies reporting that violent events linked to militant Islamic groups in the Sahel region of Africa, the transitional area between the Sahara and the Savannah, tripling over the past 12 months to nearly 400 events. Joining the Crisis Next Door to discuss this trend is Dr. David Gartenstein-Ross, a senior fellow with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. David, thank you very much for joining us here on the Crisis Next Door.
It's great to join you, Jason.
We're talking about a large geographic region stretching from the Atlantic in Africa's west to the Indian Ocean in its east. Before we get into particular groups or countries, what spawned the rise of Islamic militants in Africa, and when did this occur?
There are multiple factors that spawned this increase. If you go back to the 1990s, some of the first movements in the current wave emerged in the wake of the Afghan-Soviet War. The Afghan-Soviet War in the 1980s was a tremendous event for jihadist movements. You had multiple foreign fighters go to Afghanistan to try to repel the Soviet invaders for multiple reasons, ranging from nationalistic reasons to, in many cases, religious or fundamentalist reasons. And this put a lot of people in a battlefield where not only could they hone their skills, but they were talking to other movements from different countries who they hadn't been exposed to before. In the 1990s, before the 9/11 attacks, you had three major Islamist insurgencies in Africa. One of them was in Algeria. The Algerian Civil War was a tremendous and tragic event stretching from the 1990s until the early 2000s. Over 100,000 people died in that civil war. You also had the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group in Libya, which ended up getting crushed by the Gaddafi regime, though it made a comeback with the revolution in 2011, at least its members did. And then in Egypt, you had a variety of militant Islamic groups that threatened the Mubarak regime during the course of the 1990s. Now, when you get into the reason why these emerged, it's obviously more than the Afghan-Soviet War. You have certain background reasons, such as bad governance, corruption. You also had Saudi proselytizing, in which the Wahhabi strain of Islam, which tends to be correlated strongly with Salafi jihadist outlooks, was propagated in countries that would later become significant battle zones. Somalia, for one, Ethiopia had this kind of proselytization prior to the uptick in militant movements in that country. In other places, you've just had a complete governmental collapse. That was the case in Somalia. In Mali, you no longer have a functioning government in the northern part of the country, where the insurgency is very strong. Then in other countries, you have other reasons. For Tunisia, you have both corruption at a governmental level, and in particular, a poorly structured economy that has incentivized youth unemployment. So as you can expect, with such a big geographic swath, as you describe, you have multiple reasons, but those are some of the common themes that pervade.
How much of an influence have Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State had on the rise of jihadism in Africa?
That's a significant debate. I personally would say that they have had a lot. You know, the argument against is that the background factors pushing people towards militancy are so strong that even absent Al-Qaeda and ISIS, you would still have militant groups emerge. Now, this debate is ultimately hard to resolve because we don't live in a world where we get to see what the outcome would have been absent these two actors. But what's significant is that the majority of militant groups in Africa are at least on the Islamist side of the coin. And there obviously are a large number of militant groups that are not Islamist in orientation. But on the Islamist side of the coin, the majority of organizations do claim allegiance to al-Qaeda or to ISIS. Sometimes it's not public. Sometimes you have non-public allegiance. Now, again, there's a scholarly debate about what that allegiance means. Does the fact that people say that they are tied to al-Qaeda mean that they're actually a part of the organization, that they would actually take orders from its leadership? And that's a debate that often can only be fully resolved in retrospect, though I'd say that the evidence that's available actually suggests a stronger hand than some scholars believe. So, for example, in northern Mali, when you had al-Qaeda's North African affiliate seize control of that geography for a period that preceded the French intervention in January of 2013, documents that were subsequently uncovered show coordination between the Northern Malian branch and al-Shabaab in Somalia and others. Likewise, recently released documents show that Boko Haram had received some fairly noteworthy material support from al-Qaeda's leadership before it ended up defecting from al-Qaeda and joining ISIS. So there's some ambiguity, but you have certainly publicly claimed allegiances on the one hand, and on the other, as evidence has become available, it has tended to show concrete organizational linkages and concrete support.
Do al-Qaeda and the Islamic State have similar aims in Africa? Do they pose potential conflict to each other?
They certainly are in conflict with each other in Africa as elsewhere. They have similar aims, but somewhat dissimilar methods. Both of them aim ultimately to reestablish the caliphate. And, prior to that aim, obviously ISIS did claim at one point to have reestablished the caliphate, but its claims of having a caliphate no longer really stand following its geographic collapse in Iraq and Syria. But one of those the things that would precede the ultimate reestablishment on both of their parts is the establishment of emirates, which would be set up and governed by affiliates of those organizations and ruled according to a very strict version of Islamic law. We saw something approximating an emirate set up in northern Mali prior to the 2013 French intervention. That was linked to al-Qaeda. Boko Haram, likewise, in 2013, seized significant territory in Borno State. In 2014, rather. It seized significant territory in Borno State and was able to hold that territory into 2015, ruling it according to its strict version of Islamic law. Likewise, when the Islamic State captured Sirte, which was a Libyan city, it did similarly. So both of them have a somewhat similar method and very similar goals, though their approach differs. ISIS has tended to prefer a relationship of dominance. It tends to assert its strength and do so in a way that makes it a target of everybody. So Libya, when ISIS captured the city of Sirte, there was a civil war going on in the country, and the two warring sides couldn't agree on much. Indeed, factions that were aligned with al-Qaeda captured Derna for a significant period, and nobody seemed particularly bothered by it. But when ISIS captured Sirte, made themselves so toxic, the only thing the two warring sides of the civil war could agree upon was that they wanted ISIS out of Sirte. Al-Qaeda, on the other hand, has a more low-key low-key method for gaining control. That's not to say that it's low-key in any real sense of the term, but compared to ISIS, it is a gradualist approach. It will work with others. It will work through front groups. In Derna, for example, the local group is called the Derna Mujahideen Shura Council, and there's debate among some analysts as to whether they're really tied to al-Qaeda. Again, without getting into those debates, that's a similar method that al-Qaeda has used from one theater to another. In Yemen, when it captured the port city of al-Mukalla, for a period, rather than claiming it in al-Qaeda's name, it set up an umbrella organization called the Sons of Hadramut, which was designed to make it seem less of an al-Qaeda-held city, to be less alarming to people. In Syria, when Jabhat al-Nusra, which was what al-Qaeda's affiliate was called a few years ago, first came into the country, even though it made clear that it was aligned with an al-Qaeda-like vision, it was a long time before that organization revealed that it was actually an affiliate of al-Qaeda. Again, they're coming in, they're not establishing an al-Qaeda presence, at least not an overt one, even though they have a physical presence in the country. The way I sometimes put it is ISIS wants you to think that they're everywhere. Al-Qaeda wants you to believe instead that they're nowhere. So similar goals, similar intermediate steps, but a very different approach. ISIS is loud, al-Qaeda is not.
Let's get to a couple of the groups doing the worst damage. Al-Shabaab has been conducting devastating attacks across Somalia for years, as well as incursions into neighboring Kenya, Ethiopia, Uganda. How much of Somalia itself is controlled by Al-Shabaab right now?
Right now, Al-Shabaab does not control any urban areas of the country. If you go back a few years, for quite some time, it controlled the majority of southern Somalia, other than the capital of Mogadishu. But the African Union and its mission there is called AMISOM, was able to make significant advances against Shabaab, pushing it out of all the major urban areas. The last urban area that it lost was Kismayo, which is a coastal city. That being said, today it looks a lot like a Maoist-style insurgency. Maoist insurgencies would make an effort to control the rural areas, and as they would capture, as they would both energize the rural population and gain support there, the idea was that eventually they could lead a broader revolt. And the reason I analogize it to a Maoist-style insurgency is because Shabaab is very strong outside of the urban areas, and there's a widespread belief among analysts that as the African Union withdraws, Shabaab will either take back territory or else will be in a strong position, at the very least, to contest for territory.
What are Shabaab's goals?
Shabaab's goals are similar to the other goals of the groups. Now, let me make something clear here. When there's debate among scholars about goals, there's two different things. One is kind of the professed ideological goals. Those goals include establishment of Islamic law, eventually establishment of a broader supranational entity. We can see those goals are indeed held by these groups. When Shabaab captured southern Somalia, it implemented a very strict version of Sharia law. Same thing in northern Mali, same thing in Sirte with ISIS, same thing with Boko Haram in Bordo State. So those ideological goals are common among the groups. There also are local goals. And looking to the supranational or the ideological goals doesn't discount the more local goals. In Shabaab's case, number one, the country has been mired in a state of anarchy or semi-anarchy since the collapse of the Siad-Barre regime in the early 1990s. One thing that it professes a desire to do locally is to end that state of anarchy. A second thing is the Ethiopian intervention in Somalia has been a point of contention. There's a history between Ethiopia and Somalia, and there also are some nationalist dimensions to Shabaab's to Shabaab's fight. Essentially, it claims to fight for Somali nationhood, Somali sovereignty. There also are some kind of regional ambitions embedded within this. One thing that is embedded within Shabaab's thought is the idea of a greater Somalia, which is a notion that has long been a part of Somali political thought. In surrounding countries, Djibouti, Ethiopia, and Kenya, there are majority Somali areas. And the idea of the greater Somalia is that these majority Somali areas are basically a symptom of poorly drawn colonial boundaries, and Somalia should actually encompass all of that. So there's these both a mix of the supranational and the ideological, along with localized drivers and localized goals as well, in the case of Shabab. And similarly, as you go country to country, you'll find that dynamic mix of ideological, supranational visions, actual assistance to other jihadist groups outside of their national boundaries, but also localized grievances and a localized agenda that coexists with ideological and supranational agenda.
You're listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks, and we're talking with Dr. David Gartenstein-Ross, a senior fellow with the Foundation for Defensive Democracies, and we're chatting about the rise in jihadism in Africa. David, let's move over to Nigeria and Boko Haram. Nigeria is a massive state, around 180 million people, in a country the size of Germany and France combined. And Boko Haram has gained infamy for its brutal attacks on civilians, including mass kidnappings of schoolgirls. How does Boko Haram differ from Al-Shabaab, and what are its aims?
Boko Haram's aims, again, are it has both a mix of supranational aims and also more localized aims. In terms of how it functions specifically, it at this point is much weaker than Shabaab. While Shabaab has become a fairly successful rural insurgency, it's clear that it's gaining more capacity and the ability to come back. Boko Haram has a few different problems. One problem is that, you know, following its rise in Borno State and its, you know, capture of the majority of the state other than the state capital of Maiduguri, you had a four-country offensive that pushed Boko Haram back. And subsequently, you got significant splits within its leadership. The leader of Boko Haram, the erstwhile leader, Abu Bakr Shekau, was displaced by ISIS against his will. They announced that another leader of the organization, Barnawi, would take over as ISIS's sanctioned leader of the organization. So there's been a fracturing within that organization, with different individuals vying for leadership, while at the same time, both of these factions claim to have allegiance to ISIS.
How effective has Nigeria's counterinsurgency strategy been?
I think it's an open question. We can judge its effectiveness by its success in pushing Boko Haram back. And, you know, it didn't do that alone. But one of the questions with counterinsurgency is always, when military efforts are undertaken, what kind of damage will be done that will pave the way for future insurgencies to take root? So one of the concerns that commentators have, you know, looking outside of Nigeria to Syria and Iraq, where you've had thorough reporting on the ground, is that it seems that all the conditions for a renewed insurgency are in place in those countries. As ground was taken back from ISIS, the Sunni population often found itself brutalized by, for example, the what's called the PMCs, the Popular Mobilization Committees, which are Shia militias. You know, atrocities do happen in wartime, but it also seems as though there have been some excessive violations, as well as grievances against the YPG, which is the Kurdish organization that's taken ground back from ISIS in northern Syria. So turning back to Nigeria, the same sort of concerns exist there as well. Both are more grievances created during the course of taking ground back from Boko Haram militarily. And secondly, are the various grievances, you know, leaving aside military operations, are the various sort of grievances and problems that help Boko Haram to take power in Borno State and to gain adherence elsewhere, are those being addressed? Given the, you know, levels of corruption in Nigeria and other problems with governance, I think most observers are somewhat skeptical. The Boko Haram problem is on the road to being solved, though at the same time, there is hope among many observers that they won't be able to gain enough strength that they'll become a significant territorial entity again.
Foreign fighters have been a key component to al-Qaeda and the Islamic State in the Middle East. Are jihadists in Africa also receiving an overseas influx of recruits?
There are foreign fighters in Africa. It's not similar to what we saw in Iraq and Syria. We don't have the same sort of magnet for a variety of reasons. But one could look at any sort of recent operations or recent fighting and see that there is some foreign fighter hand. There were multiple foreign fighters in Somalia, though they ended up in conflict with Shabab's leadership. Omar Hamami was a very famous Alabaman who went over to Somalia, clashed with Shabab's leadership, and ended up getting killed. Going to other operations, like there's a very infamous attack against oil and gas facilities in Algeria. It was an attack in Amenas, and foreign fighters were involved in that significant military operation. So there are foreign fighters there, but far, far fewer for a variety of reasons than you have in the Syria and Iraq conflict.
It's been widely reported that Niger has leaned on local militias to help with counterinsurgency operations in Mali and Niger. How effective is that strategy? There have been criticism that those militias could inflame intercommunal tensions. Is that a key worry?
It is a key worry. It's a little bit hard to fully assess. And the reason why is, number one, you have limited reporting on the ground. Number two, when it comes to things like use of militias or other other kind of entities that are not part of a military chain of command, one has to factor in what the alternatives are, as well as compare those militias to the professionalism of the army. So in Nigeria, leaving aside Niger, in Nigeria, you had private military companies used in some of the advances against Boko Haram. Private military companies are extremely controversial, as I'm sure any of your listeners understand. But probably when one compares the PMCs, the private military companies, to the average Nigerian military unit, they actually probably were somewhat more effective on the battlefield, at least according to the reports that I have seen about that conflict. Likewise, I mentioned PMCs, a different kind of PMC, Popular Mobilization Committees, in Iraq and Syria. These are largely backed by Iran. I mentioned the atrocities that they were committing, but the Iraqi state certainly made the decision, as did the Assad government, that it wanted these militia units to be part of the fight against ISIS, and in the case of the Assad regime, against other rebel groups as well. Turning to Iraq, which is, there's a big difference between the Iraqi government and the Assad regime in terms of legitimacy, the brutality that they'll accept and the like. But turning to Iraq, it's not necessarily a poor decision. When one looks at, ISIS, its ability to hold territory, the atrocities it was committing. We found, at this point, there's been over 30 mass graves found in Iraq, and it's probably just the tip of the iceberg. Being able to rally local support and have a military capability that's outside of the normal military chain of command was a rational decision. One can debate it, but it certainly was a rational decision. Likewise, when one looks to the future of conflict in Africa, we will increasingly see fighting done by groups that aren't purely military. There'll be use of militias and other groups that I call violent non-state actors. There's a number of reasons driving this, but essentially, as governance declines, as it becomes important to have some sort of military capability, as communities look to self-protection, we'll see more and more sub-state armed groups that are part of the military and part of the strategic environment.
One final question. How do you view the international response to jihadism in Africa?
That's a good question. It's mixed. Generally speaking, there's a difficulty for states trying to battle violent non-state actors. And one thing I often compare this to is the economic sphere, where you have a competition between startup firms and legacy industries. Startup firms tend to be smaller than legacy industries, able to shift their strategies quickly, wedded to the latest in technology. And this often gives them advantage against legacy industries. Legacy industries like, you know, Borders Books or Blockbuster Video or Toys R Us, which have a big name but are a legacy of a different time and of a different competition. States often look a lot like legacy industries. They're very bureaucratic. There's a lot of reasons why they have trouble implementing policy well. And I think that one of the challenges of the 21st century, as you know, it's not just in the fight against violent non-state actors, but there are multiple ways in which states confront threats that are fast moving, that require a response, and it's difficult to coordinate against all levels of government quickly enough. I'm thinking through this dimension of legacy industries versus startup firms is important, because governments need to move, in my view, at least somewhat in the direction of startup firms, less bureaucratized, more able to undertake quick strategic shifts. These are things that private industry often is good at, and government has a bigger problem at. And Africa is reflective of that, only it's even more of a problem than it is in certain other regions, because you have both a lot of kind of misgovernance across numerous African countries, much more so than in the West or even the Middle East. You have countries that on net are poorer, with governments that are less well-resourced, and you have more countries in which capacity to govern is just drastically declining. And so the local partners are not up to the same sort of level that you have even in, say, Iraq.
Certainly a fertile ground for those violent non-state actors. Very eye-opening. David, thank you very much for joining us here on The Crisis Next Door.
My pleasure. It was great joining you.
And thanks for joining us on The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. We've been talking with Dr. David Gartenstein-Ross, a senior fellow with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Till next time.
The Crisis Next Door with host Jason Brooks is produced weekly.
If you have any thoughts for Jason, email him at tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com. Again, that's tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.